And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, Indian trade unions plead for worldwide support to free 13 auto workers sentenced to life in prison.
But first, what's happening in South Sudan and the role of the United States? Professor Milton Alamadi examines the background of the ongoing conflict in South Sudan, which has created untold suffering, tens of thousands of deaths, and over a million displaced people forced out of their homes. Violence is escalating in South Sudan, and famine has been declared in parts of southern Sudan. As of 2016, estimates of victims of the war in South Sudan have already exceeded 100,000, and thousands more have been killed since that time. The United States High Commission for Refugees reported that 1 million refugees have been created since December 2013. Professor Alamadi talks about what underlies the conflict and what is the role of the U.S. and the U.N. The U.S. is the primary financial supporter of the government in South Sudan.
Professor Alamadi places a large part of the responsibility on General Museveni, dictator of the neighboring Uganda, who seeks a regional hegemony and has sent forces and military and in support of Salva Kiir. Uganda, he reports, is a super major ally of the United States and often does its bidding in regional conflicts. Military aid to Uganda, funded by the U.S. tax dollars, has been used against the civilians in South Sudan. Alamadi also says that Americans can play a critical role in ending the massacres since the U.S. provides $750 million annually to the Museveni regime.
Professor Milton Alamadi is a professor at John Jay, and he is the publisher of Black Star News. So let's listen to Professor Milton Alamadi, and then you're going to make sure to sign the petition that he wrote that appears in Black Star News. Let's listen.
Thank you. Greetings, sisters and brothers. When you see the conflict, not only in South Sudan, but in other countries, whether it's an African country, whether it's Syria, and you see the humanitarian catastrophe, you probably wonder, what can I do? Because sometimes these conflicts look like they're spontaneous, like they're always happening, so you're confused. Can we really do something effectively about it? So I'm here tonight with reference to South Sudan to say that yes, indeed, we can play a critical role, because in South Sudan, as well as in many African countries, the United States exerts considerable influence. In fact, the predominant influence, particularly in South Sudan, the United States is the primary sponsor of the Ugandan government. Uganda receives about $750 million a year in U.S. taxpayer support, and about $170 million of that goes to the military. So why am I starting with Uganda and not South Sudan? Because Uganda is the major player in South Sudan, has been the major player for many years now. And without dealing with Uganda's undue and negative and destructive influence in what is going on in South Sudan, we will not be able to resolve this problem. So this means we have to address the U.S. support for Uganda. Only the U.S. really can rein in the Ugandan regime, get it to change its destructive course in South Sudan. So let me give you some very brief background. South Sudan won its independence in 2011. It had been engaged in many decades of warfare against the central government in Khartoum, which did not have much positive contribution toward the southern part of the country. And that's why the South felt the urge to break away from the rest of Sudan. Ultimately, a deal was negotiated and South Sudan became an independent nation in 2011. And Salva Kiir became president and Riek Machar became vice president. They had led for many decades different units which ultimately had merged as the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement and Liberation Army. In 2013, a political crisis emerged between Salva Kiir and Riek Machar. Most of the regional African countries became involved in trying to resolve the situation. They wanted to mediate between the two when hostilities broke out. So Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and several countries, Sudan, became involved in negotiating a solution. But while Uganda was officially part of the mediators, Yoweri Museveni, the ruler of Uganda, for the last 31 years, was playing a very destructive role. He actually sent his army into South Sudan to support one side in this conflict, which was President Salva Kiir's side. This exacerbated the situation. Rather than a political crisis, now we have a full-fledged civil war with atrocities being committed by the government army as well as the armed supporters of Riek Machar, who himself was driven out of the country into exile. But a lot of pressure came to bear on both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar because of the humanitarian catastrophe that was being created by this conflict. Ultimately, a deal was arrived at, a peace agreement was signed. Salva Kiir signed very reluctantly, but he signed nonetheless. In fact, the U.S. is on the record as saying he would be sanctioned personally if he did not sign the deal to end the conflict. So he put certain conditions that he added unilaterally as an addendum before he signed. But he signed ultimately anyway in August 2015, and the same government was put back together. Riek Machar came back from exile and became the first vice president with Salva Kiir as president. This arrangement, the transitional government of national unity, lasted only until last year in July. Once again, Salva Kiir attacked his vice president's president and forces, and again drove him out of the country. And that is how we arrived at the calamity that we now face in South Sudan. And I believe Salva Kiir attacked because he knew that he could always rely on the military support of Uganda. Museveni would prefer to have Salva Kiir as the only person in charge of South Sudan. And that is the problem. So now the United Nations appointed a group of experts to study the situation, and they delivered a report to the Security Council in April. In this report, it makes clear Uganda's negative role in this conflict. It also blames Salva Kiir for being primarily responsible for the escalation beginning in July 2016. And it describes some of the most unimaginable atrocities that are being carried out against unarmed civilians, against women, against children, where even children have been dismembered and thrown in the rivers. How do you do this to other human beings? And that is how the refugee crisis has been created. Now we have 800,000 in Uganda, maybe about 2 million displaced domestically, and 60% of these are children. The report also makes it clear that there's only a political solution to this conflict, even though it makes clear that Salva Kiir is still trying to pursue a military solution. The report also makes clear that there cannot be a solution without bringing Riek Machar back into the equation. So obviously, you start thinking of what are some possible viable solutions. That's why, if some of you saw the article that I wrote in the Daily News, an op-ed, my proposal was that perhaps both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar should be have their forces disarmed and bring a truly neutral international force to provide security in the country and to act as the police force and to also protect the country from Uganda, to make sure that Uganda's army would no longer be able to influence events in southern Sudan, while at the same time you're providing security for the South Sudanese, you're bringing a force that has no incentive to commit atrocities against the people of South Sudan, and that is why I made that suggestion. So the question that you may be asking yourself, why is Uganda playing such a destructive role in South Sudan? A number of reasons. Number one, the Ugandan dictator has been in power for 31 years. How has he been able to accomplish that? The United States provides Uganda with $750 million. The United States trains Uganda's army. The United States has a base, a military base, in Uganda. That is how he's been able to survive for such a long time. And what does he do in return for the United States? He serves as the regional policeman. Just like Mobutu, the dictator of Zaire, which is now Democratic Republic of Congo, used to do in the 60s and 70s, a reliable U.S. agent in the region. So, for example, when the U.S. wanted African troops to be based in war-torn Somalia, try to prevent al-Shabaab from taking over the government there, Uganda was very happy to provide 10,000 soldiers, which it did. So in return, General Museveni gets a blank check. So what incentive does he have in crises in South Sudan? By creating turmoil in other countries, it deflects from his own repression within Uganda. So right now, even though there's a lot of political pressure in Uganda, when compared to South Sudan, you know, Uganda would appear almost like paradise. And he does that deliberately. This is not the first time. He's done it with neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo, were invaded in 1997. That led to atrocities, multiple wars, and the Congo has lost an estimated anywhere from 6 to 10 million people as a result. And that was due to Uganda's invasion. So he creates regional turmoil to divert attention from his own domestic repression. But then there's a second critical issue which has emerged in South Sudan. South Sudan has oil. And that, I believe, is now playing a role as well in the crisis. There's been media reports that there's some shady companies based in Uganda, based in Kenya, and some based in Ethiopia that are brokering oil deals with Salva Kiir. And obviously Salva Kiir is desperate for financing to buy arms, so he's signing these oil deals. One reported deal was signed with a company called Aranto, which is supposedly owned by a Nigerian. And I say supposedly owned because a few years ago, Aranto signed an oil deal in Liberia, but then within a very short time, sold that concession to Chevron. Now, recently, Aranto signed a deal, reportedly, with Salva Kiir. Aranto promised $500 million. I don't know if that money was paid or not. But Aranto does not have the capacity to exploit oil. So I will not be surprised if Aranto's intention is to sell that concession to to another company? Might it be Chevron? Might it be another U.S. company? Might it be other major oil company? Who knows? But that's the recent development. So now the question emerges, are oil interests also escalating and perpetrating this war by supporting Salva Kiir, thinking they can do business deals with them, even though they know quite clearly well, as the UN said, without bringing Riek Machar back into the equation, this conflict is just going to continue. And of course, the biggest victims, as we are aware, are the civilians, the women, the children, and the elderly. Let me add one other point on how diabolically clever this Ugandan dictator is. Now you have about 800 to 900,000 refugees from South Sudan being hosted in Uganda. But now what is Museveni doing? He's trying to milk political and diplomatic capital out of this. So even though he was the primary arsonist, because when Uganda intervened in 2013 to support Salva Kiir, it was quite ruthless. So anyway, now you have the arsonist who exacerbated the crisis in South Sudan, wanting to be a diplomatic player now. So he has proposed, and the United Nations has agreed, to co-host a refugee solidarity conference in Uganda, co-hosted by dictator Museveni, and one of the guests is going to be the Secretary General of the United Nations. The same United Nations who discussed a report in April implicating Uganda in these atrocities. Now you're going to have the diplomatic image of the Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres, standing on some podium with the arsonist in Uganda and talking about the good work that Museveni is doing by hosting the refugees from South Sudan, when he, in fact, is the one that lit the fire. And that is why I created a petition, change.org, and I invite everyone who wants to do something to go to that petition. It is addressed, Guterres, don't let Museveni use UN to politicize suffering of South Sudan refugees. I hope you read that petition. If you agree with it, I hope you do sign it as well. Thank you.
Sign the petition that Professor Milton Alamadi wrote that appears in Black Star News. Now to another most serious issue.
Free the Marudi workers! Workers' rights are human rights. Free the Marudi workers! Labor rights are not a crime. Free the Marudi workers!
Well, it always seems a bit contradictory to be in one of the most posh areas of the city to have come here to India House to be talking about freeing 13 Indian Maruti Suzuki auto workers. Why don't you tell us exactly what brings you here and the story of the 13 workers?
I had the great fortune of being able to travel to India when I was working as a labor organizer. And I had learned of the story of the Maruti Suzuki auto workers from the industrial belt in Manesar, which is right outside of Delhi, from the industrial area of Manesar. In 2011, they began a very important, full and militant mobilization to organize their workforce, to create a union, to advocate for their rights to safer working conditions, better wages, and to demand that the government and the corporation comply with Indian law and give permanent status to contract labor in the factory. Struggle to unionize and to improve their conditions lasted for some time, and it helped to sort of ignite a new movement in the area for workers' rights as a whole, and it helped also to ignite nationwide support of their movement. And in July of 2012, there was an accident that occurred at the factory in which a manager was accidentally killed in circumstances that had to do with some confrontation between the workers and the management, in which were never independently investigated. After that took place, the company and the state, using the police force, went after thousands of workers, terminating thousands of workers, criminalizing and targeting and prosecuting a couple of hundred workers who were accused of having caused the death of this manager. And there was no evidence at all to link any of these workers to the death of the manager. And what happened instead was that the company had created a list of union leaders and active union members and said to the police force, these are the workers that are responsible for what happened. And some of the workers that were rounded up and detained were not even present at the factory at the time the incident took place. It was clear to many people that the targeting and rounding up of these workers and the use of violence against these workers and the subsequent prosecution was mainly a retaliation for their efforts to unionize, that they actually are entitled to under Indian law as well as international law. It's been about 3 years since the workers were first rounded up. Over 140 workers were finally given bail after 2 years of imprisonment, despite absolute lack of evidence against them. Other workers remained in prison, and the trial finally came to be after 4 years. 13 workers who were charged with the crime of murder were facing the death penalty. And people around the world and throughout India were quite concerned about what would happen. There were letters that were sent to Indian embassies around the world demanding that they save the lives of these workers and release them, because there's absolutely no evidence to sort of warrant these charges against them. On March 18th, we learned that the workers were not given the death penalty, thank God, but they were given life in prison. We see that the 13 being sentenced to life in prison is an absolute travesty, an absolute injustice. It exists because the government and the capitalist classes are trying to protect the profits of these companies, and those profits are undermined when workers organize and mobilize. We had a really, really good number of people in front of the Indian consulate today from unions like PSC CUNY and Unite Here, and lawyers, and we had students and here, not just because of their concern of these workers, but because they're also aware that the profits that come out of the manufacturing of these automobile plants in India also seep into the pockets of capitalists in the United States. Wall Street is invested in the companies that manufacture in India, and so we want to be able to have a consistent conversation as a global social justice community to say that we will not allow for the rule of law to be used to cater to the interests of the capitalist class and to allow for the repression of workers who have every right to stand up for themselves and for their communities. You know, and we want to just send a message to the Maruti workers and their families and all their supporters in India that we will continue to raise our voice in support of their struggle. We're inspired by their struggle to organize on a class basis and the way that they have been, as much as on a community basis. And I'm just so grateful that everybody came out here today. And I feel like there's a lot more that we can do. And this is not the first time that the Indian consulate is going to hear from us.
Can you tell us anything about the specific plant and where the Maruti workers unionized?
The plant is actually the largest auto manufacturing plant in India. And it was originally a national company that was privatized in the early 90s during the period of liberalization. And eventually, the Suzuki company became one of the largest owners of the company, hence the name being changed from Maruti to Maruti Suzuki. And in 2012, we had a delegation of lawyers and union organizers from the United States and from Japan and from European countries that went to do an investigation of what had occurred at the plant and what had occurred prior to the incident of July 2012. That was a delegation that was organized by the International Commission for Labor Rights. They published a report showing the types of conditions that the workers had to endure for a very long time, including a kind of speed up of the day-to-day production of automobiles that for many of us seemed to be inhuman, like how much they expected these workers to work within a few minutes' time, like how much they expected them to basically use their body. It was a very dehumanizing way that they were expected to sort of speed up their production of the Maruti Suzuki product. All other sorts of conditions that were jeopardizing the safety and the health of these workers. One of the reasons that people viewed the struggle of the Maruti workers and others like them to be so significant is that in their demands, they also made sure that the issue of contract labor was front and center. In many, many factories, not just in India, but around the world, but what we saw in the Indian automobile industry was that increasingly the workforces are becoming precarious, in that the workforce is either under temporary contract or in this really limbo apprentice status where they just sort of remain apprentices for like an indefinite period of time and never become permanent. And you start to see this pattern within the industries in which majority of the workforce has no permanency whatsoever. They're much more susceptible to that kind of exploitation in terms of wages, conditions. And when you do not have permanent status, it's much easier for you to be terminated, and much easier for you to be a target of retaliation if you try to organize. And so it undermines the power of all workers when the majority of the workforce are temporary and have less power within the plant. And so the Maruti struggle was important in the way that it centered this question of contract labor. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, you know, the state and the company saw that movement as being threatening. You know, it's important to realize that about this particular struggle, because I think it's going to be reflected in many struggles that we see happening in the future around the world.
Whom we're speaking to?
My name is Suzanne Adeli, and I'm a global labor and human rights lawyer, and I'm with the National Lawyers Guild International Committee. I'm part of a very loose network of labor solidarity activists called the Global Worker Solidarity Network.
I can testify that she certainly is, and there's probably not a global struggle that she hasn't been part of, not to mention incredible work around Egypt and Palestine and so on. And so now the critical thing, what is it that we have to tell our listeners to do for the Maruti Suzuki work?
They can go on Facebook, look up the page for the Global Worker Solidarity Network, and there we will have more information about the case. They can also visit a blog that is run by the Provisional Working Committee of the Maruti Suzuki Workers Union. It's very easy to find. It's just called marutisuzukiworkersunion.wordpress.com, and they can find the blog and they can find the most recent message from the workers about what's taking place and how they can support them.
And what's our last chant here?
Free the Maruti workers! Free the Maruti workers! Free the Maruti workers!
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.